Lecture 22, Remark, All Quiet on the Western Front.
In our last lecture, we examined the idea of duty. Just that simple, duty. We looked at the funeral oration of Pericles, delivered in the Athenian democracy of 430 BC, at the time of its great war against Sparta. And we compared it to Abraham Lincoln's funeral oration, the Gettysburg Address, delivered on the 19th of November in 1863, during the great war that is our American Civil War. And we saw that both of these true statesmen, leaders of great democracy, told their fellow citizens that your supreme duty is to die for your country. And time again throughout history, men and women have been torn from their ordinary pursuits, from their duties towards their family, towards their job, towards their friends, towards themselves, and sent into the line of battle to die for their country, to fight and to die for their country. So this question of duty is one of supreme importance. And I ask you at the end of that lecture to ponder the question. Do you believe that the noblest thing you can do for your country, that the noblest thing you can do overall, is to die for your country? And the generation that grew up in the years before 1914, the generation of the first decade of the 20th century, that new century, was taught that, and most of them believed it. Indeed, they were the first generation in which compulsory education played a major role. And boys in France and Britain, Germany, Italy, and in the United States were educated to be patriots. The literature that they read, the Greek and Latin that they studied, the history that they studied, hammered home this point of the glory of war and the nobility of dying for your country. They read Horace, Dulce decor est pro patria mori. It is a sweet and fitting thing to do, to die for your country. Their hearts sang with Achilles before the walls of Troy. They read the Aeneid and learned about dutiful Aeneas and the great war he had to fight. And they read the funeral oration of Pericles. Its grammar analyzed, and its theme of sacrifice for your country made one with their heart. And in our country, they memorized the Gettysburg Address. And of course, they could still talk with the veterans of that great war. And long removed from the battlefield at Gettysburg, these old men would sing of how glorious it was to fight that battle and of the brave Johnny Rebs they went up against. And this was the generation that marched off, throwing its hats up in the air in August of 1914, for they were going to have their chance to fight and to win for their country. And if they died, well, they would have done the noblest possible thing. And their only worry was the war would be too short. They wouldn't get into action. Well, 4 long years later, that lesson had been learned by those of them who survived. And so many of them would come out of that war, again, if they lived in a war that cost 11 million lives, quite convinced that the most stupid thing you could do was to die for your country, and that war was not a noble thing, it was one great fraud imposed upon ordinary people by incompetent leaders. That was the message in the greatest novel ever written about war, as it has been rightly called, Im Westen Nichts Neues, All Quiet on the Western Front, published in 1929 by a veteran of that great war, Erich Maria Remarque. It tells the story of the war and its cost through the eyes of one ordinary soldier, Paul Bellmer, clearly the prototype for Eric Maria Remarque himself and his experiences in the Great War. This book is neither an indictment nor a confession, says Remarque in his preface. It intends simply to tell the story of a generation that was destroyed by the war, even those of us who escaped its shells. It begins in the very middle of things, 1916, when Bellmer has been in the war for 2 years. And it starts off quite simply, you know, we're feeling happy. Our bellies are full. They are full of sausage and beans and bread, and I've got enough cigarettes to last me for the whole day. Why? Well, we went into action. It was a big push. And our company consisted of 150 men, our unit did, and when it was over, they were 80. We'd run into some very big guns. But the order to bring up rations for us had been given before the action started. So the cook came up with rations for 150 men. And we came up, smelt that bean, those beans cooking, and that sausage bubbling there, and we said, we're ready to eat. And he said, I got to wait for the whole unit to be here. And we said, we are the whole unit. And he said, no, you're not. We said, yes, we are. We're all that's left. And he said, I've got 150 portions here. And we said, great, for once we'll have enough. And he said, I cannot feed 150 rations to 80 men. Why not? It's not regulations. And suddenly, one of their members, a member of the little group that hangs together, Cat, says, wait a minute. Kaczynski's his real name, but Cat, a 40-year-old man who used to be a shoemaker, says, are you telling me you're not going to feed us? That's right. Suddenly seeing the brouhaha, an officer comes by and says, what's the problem here? And the cook says, I can't feed them these rations. Why not? They're only 80 men. I've got rations for 150. Give them those beans and send some over to my tent, too, when you're done. You hear me, cook? Yes, sir. There you are. We just lost half our number, and we can't even get a decent meal. Well, now we've got it, and we are happy. And we just sit there smoking and watching the airplanes circling up in the sky, and we talk a little bit about the war, though we try to forget it. And the question is, of course, why are we here? Do you hate anybody in France? No, by golly, I don't. In fact, says one of them, Chaden, who's a farmer, I've never even met anybody from France except to kill them. How about you, Paul? No, no, I don't hate anybody from France. How about those Tommies over there? No. And I don't suspect any of those Tommies over there hate me. Well, why are we fighting them? I guess because the diplomats and the politicians couldn't figure out any other way to settle this. You mean they couldn't figure out any other way to settle a little dispute about who shot the Archduke of Austria than to send us into this war? Why, do you know, says Cat, the finest scientific minds of the world are working day and night just to come up with new ways to kill me. And you're telling me that the politicians didn't have a better solution? Well, you know what, says one of the cagey ones, Chaden, you know what they ought to do? When they get into a problem like this, they ought to take the Kaiser and the King of England and the Tsar of Russia and whatever France has and put them in a big circle with a club and let them beat each other's brains out. And whoever comes out of it, why, they win. And then they wouldn't have bothered me at all. I wish I were home right now with the flowers and the garden and smelling that good earth. How about you, Paul? Where would you like to be right now? I don't know. You see, men like Cat and you, why, you had lives before all of this started. But we had nothing. We were schoolboys. Yeah, how did you enlist? How did all of us enlist? All of you? Yeah, there are only four of us left, but our whole class enlisted. August 1914, I remember the day. Our teacher, Professor Kantorek, for professors in German high schools in those days, teachers in German high schools were called professors. And he was our professor of Greek and Latin. He was a classicist. He also taught us literature and history. And Professor Kantorek came in and said, Ihr seid das eigene Jugend Deutschlands. You are the iron youth of Germany. And now your country calls upon you. Do you not remember Bellmer, the Spartans at Thermopylae? Yes, I remember the Spartans at Thermopylae. Did they lay down their lives for their country? Yes, they did. 300 Spartans standing against 1,000,000 of the Persian king's men. And when they died, to the last man, do you remember? Say it to me in Greek. How These are they who laid down the splendor of their young lives. We are no more, but we died true to the way of our country. Go tell the Lacedaemonians that. They laid down the splendor of their young lives, Balmer. Can you do any less for your country? What about it? You're their leader, Balmer. You're the class leader. What do you say? Let's all go down and enlist. I'll go down with you, boys. I'll go. Kemmerick? I don't want to go. He's kind of a fat boy. Ooh, I don't want to go. My mom won't let me go. Your mom won't let you go. Let's go. Don't be the only one left out. What will the girls say? I'll go, too. And so he marched us down there. And we chanted the Iliad, you know, while we went down there. Meni daideithia peliadio achilios. And we all enlisted. Of course, not Professor Cantorek. Those professors, those teachers, they keep their feelings in their vest pocket and they whip them out on occasions like a watch to fool boys like us. And one by one, they've killed every one of us. You know, Kemmerick, the one who didn't want to go, he was the first to be killed. Yeah, we didn't know much about it then, but we went over the top and he got wounded in the eye, and we were so worried and terrified of all the shelling that was going on that we left him there. We said, he'll get back okay, but he was knocked out. And then, late in the evening, he woke up screaming, mad with the pain, and we couldn't go out and get him. And the French, they opened up on him, and he was running around blind and screaming, and they shot him down. Well, I guess we better go over and see our comrade who's in the hospital. He's not going to make it out. I know they cut off his leg. He doesn't know that yet, does he? So they go over to the hospital tent, and there they see another comrade, worried about his boots, because his mother gave him a wonderful pair of boots, soft English airman boots, soft, wonderful leather. And he looks up and says, don't let him steal my boots. Well, don't you know that? Shut up! Don't you know he's lost his leg? Shut up. Don't tell him that. What are you trying to tell me? Nothing. Don't let him steal my boots. We won't. And he too dies. And so, our life has now been reduced to the contentment of a full belly and enough cigarettes to get us through the day. And what about what we learned in school? Balmer, what are the regulations that Lycurgus established for Sparta? What is the population of Melbourne? What a lot of nonsense all of that was. They never taught us anything worthwhile like how to light a cigarette in the wind or how to keep your mind during a bombardment. Well, the rest is over and we push up into the front again. And we're marching along, and suddenly the French open up with their great 75s. And it's a horrific bombardment coming down upon us. And we all stick close to Cat. He's the old man. He's the stable one. Hang close to me, boys. We head towards the great craters that have been hammered out. And the shells are falling in, and they're tearing up the landscape all around us. And it turns out it's a graveyard where we are. And it's churning up bodies out of the old graves. And the horses are rushing around screaming in pain, their guts dragging. And Balmer leaps into a crater hole. And suddenly, he's not alone. He's jumped in with a Frenchman. And they grapple together, and he stabs the Frenchman to death. But not quite. The Frenchman's still gurgling out a little bit of life. And all that night long and into the next day, the bombardment continues. I wonder how many of us have been under a bombardment like that, where the whole earth shakes and where men go insane, screaming and yelling and lose their minds as the bombs crash again and again. And Balmer lies there under that bombardment with that Frenchman just gurgling out his life. Shut up! Will you just shut up? Die! Why don't you? Don't die, old pal. There's no need for you to die. I've never killed a man, you know, with a bayonet like that so close up. I've smashed their heads in, but to be here with you, don't die like that. Let me look at your paybook. Oh, you're a printer. Is this your wife and children? Don't die. You'll get out of this. One last gurgle, and he's dead. Finally, the bombardment ends, and Bauma makes his way back to the German lines and shaken. And Kat says, "What's your trouble?" He says, "I was there with this Frenchman, and I killed him. And look, I've got his paybook. I'm going to write his family and tell him how sorry I am." "Yeah, well, don't do it until tomorrow, and you'll forget about it. Look at him over there. He's a sniper. Every time he shoots and kills a Frenchman or a Tommy, why, he just marks a little X. You'll get used to it. Don't worry. That's what the war does." And that's what it does, Paul Bauma realizes. It turns us into thugs. All those years in Sunday school teaching us to turn the other cheek, to do unto others. What did that mean? Why, to do unto others is to kill them. That's what we do with rifles, with our entrenching tools, with our foxhole diggers. Why, we're no different than any band of pirates or gangsters when we leap in that trench with the French. We kill as many as we can. And we steal. That's the only way we survive. The rations they give us aren't enough, and they're too irregular. So anytime we hit a village, we go around and steal everything we can just so we can eat. We're expected to do that. We're expected to kill and to steal and to do any other horrible thing for our country. The horror of the war was not just in the great shells that fell, but in the gas attacks. That's part of the scientific mind at work, in which these great nations, with their learning and their universities, turn their chemist and their physicist and their botanist and their biologist and every scientist they have and their engineers into building these terrible weapons. And none more horrifying than gas. It comes in a shell and lands, and quietly it slinks out, green and perforating through the lines under the barbed wire that is there. And you have a little canary in a cage, and if that canary suddenly dies, you know it's big trouble. And you grab for your gas mask, but you've got to get it quick enough. Gas, gas, the yell goes out all along the line, and you put it on your face. But if you're 1 minute too slow, then that poison creeps down into your lungs, and they begin to dissolve. You watch a comrade who was just 5 seconds too slow, coughing up his lungs in great green clots. They give you leave to go home, and Bauma does go home. What a mistake. What a mistake. He comes into his house, and his mother is sick in bed. She has cancer. But she gets up to fix him a special little meal. "My soldier boy is home. Paul, what have they done to you? You smoke now, Paul? I didn't know you smoked. What other bad habits have you picked up there?" "Well, Mom, I picked up killing people and stealing, but you don't tell her that." And she cooks your special little dish, your little pancakes, potato pancakes, with a special little jam that she has saved for you, whortleberry jam it is. And you spread it on there, and she says, "Eat them up, Paul, I've got more ready." They don't taste the same. All they do is remind you of everything that you've lost. But you have to eat them for Mom, and you're almost sick. And then Dad says, "Boy, we're going down to the pub, going down to the Gasthaus. I want him to meet my warrior." Dad, I'd rather stay home." "Now, boy, put on that uniform and let's go. I've been waiting for this for months, to let him see my soldier." And you go down, and there are all these old men sitting there drinking their beer. "Tell us what it's like at the front. Huh? How many Frenchies have you killed?" They won't even begin to understand what it's about. "Now, what I think we ought to do is make one final big push." By now, it's 1917, and the Americans are already coming and landing. You try to explain to them that you're outnumbered 5-1, that in fact Germany is fighting the whole world. "You're not a defeatist. Have you raised a defeatist there, Bauma?" "No, my boy's not a defeatist. You're not a defeatist, are you? You know we're going to win. One more big push, right?" "That's right, Dad. One more big push, and we'll be in Paris." "I knew it. That's the kind of spirit that motivates our boys there at the front. They'll never give up." And then, who should show up but old Cantorek, your old professor. "Bauma, you've got to come with me tomorrow to class and tell my boys what it's about. I want them to enlist." I don't think I'll be able to." "Sure you will. Paul, go with your old teacher." And he's there bright and early in the morning. He takes you to the class. Tell them what it's like at the front. What do you do there? Well, we mainly try not to get killed. Oh, don't talk like that. That's the truth. That's what we try to do, is to get from one battle to the next and not be dead. Tell them about the glorious boys that marched out with you. Well, as you know, only four of us are left. 11 are dead, a couple made officers, several have invalided out home, and one's in the madhouse. Bomber. But they died for their country gloriously. I don't know. They coughed their lungs out. They died screaming, hung up on the wire. We couldn't get to them. What's happened to you, Bomber? What's happened to you? I guess it's the war, Professor. Don't listen to him, boys. Don't listen to him. It's a great and glorious thing. One of those lines from Horace, say them again. Dulce decor est, pro patria mori. So back again to the line, carrying with him a satchel of his mom's potato pancakes. She pressed more on him. And he gets up there and he can't eat these. So he goes to the poor, starving Russian prisoners of war and gives them out to them. God, I wish I'd never gone home. I sat in my room there and pulled down the books that I used to study. Goethe and Virgil and Cicero. Speak to me again, O books of my youth. But they were silent. There's nothing in the whole long line of culture that we learned in civilization. It was all meaningless if it let us go into a war like this. Those books will never talk to me again. I am dead inside. I realize that now. I never really had a girlfriend. I never knew anything but this war, staring into this deep, dark abyss. But he's back at the line now, and there are even fewer of his old gang. But Cat's still alive, and they go out on a little foraging expedition. And there's a little shoot-up. Cat's leg seems broken. So Paul starts taking him back to the hospital tent, carrying this old man on his back, rather the way Aeneas in his school book, The Aeneid, carried his father Anchises, because Cat is now his father. They share far deeper things than he'll ever know with his father back home. Well, Cat, they tell me there's so many Americans now that this war can't last much longer. It's going to be over and we're going to go back home. And we got to stay in contact. You hear me? We'll stay in contact, Paul. And suddenly there's an airplane up above. Is that a Frenchie or an American up there? Because we sure don't have any up anymore. But suddenly just one bomb drops. Ha! He thinks he's going to hurt us with that one bomb. Well, Cat, we're at the hospital tent. Drops him down. The orderly says, what you drag him in here for? What? He's dead. No, he's not. I was just talking to him. Look. And sure enough, a little fragment from that bomb has just pierced the ear of old Cat, and he's gone too. And now the unit is filled up with nothing but young boys, 16 and 17, dragged up. And the only thing they know how to do is to get killed in one meaningless, futile assault after another. Oh, that summer of 1918. If they don't end this war soon, we will revolt. But it drags on and on and on until November 1918. And then, why, there are clear indications the war is going to come to an end. An armistice is going to be signed, and Paul has lived through it all. That is where the book ends, except for a few little asterisks, and then under it, they found him on a day so quiet that the news from the front was restricted to a single line, all quiet on the Western Front. He lay forward, his face pushed gently into the earth, with a smile upon it, as though he were almost glad the end had come. All quiet on the Western Front, im Westen nix neues. On the Western Front, nothing new. That's the better way to translate it. There was nothing new. Just one more of the 11 million dead. Paul Baumer. That message embodied the feelings of so many who fought that war. Poets among them, like the British poet Wilfred Owen, who reminds us that if you could pace behind that wagon we threw him in, this man who had been gassed, if you could pace behind that wagon that we threw him in and watch the white eyes writhing in that face, in that hanging face, like a devil sick of sin, if you could hear the blood gurgling at every jolt from his froth-corrupted lungs, like bitter cud of vile, incurable sores on innocent tongues, then, my friend, you would not tell in such high zest to the young, ardent for some desperate glory, the old lie, dulc et decor est pro patria mori. What is sweet and fitting about dying with your lungs dissolving? No passing bells for these who die as cattle, only the monstrous anger of the guns, the rifles, the stuttering rifles' rapid rattle can patter out their hasty orisons. No, no church bells chime for these who are shot down by the thousands, as they were at the Battle of the Somme, with 60,000 killed and wounded on one day of 1916. And Wilfred Owen, the poet, he would himself die on November the 4th, 1918, only 7 days before the armistice. But it was a war with purpose, I tell you that. It was not a meaningless struggle. It was a war, the Great War, that put an end for that brief period to Germany's desire to dominate Europe. And the lesson that was learned was thrown away, as Winston Churchill would point out. So some men met their death, like Wilfred Owen, thinking it was all a terrible mistake. Others were simply stoic, like the American poet Alan Seeger. He was a Harvard graduate, and he was living in France, and this was a great chance to be in the war. It was going to be over before he could show what he was made of. So he joined the French Foreign Legion, and there, with all those legionnaires, was thrown into the thickest part of the battle and into struggles that were too severe and where the casualties would be too great and create too much public outcry if regular French troops were used. And there he died on July the 4th, 1916. "I have a rendezvous with death," he wrote. "At some disputed barricade, when spring comes rustling round with shade, and apple blossoms fill the air, I have a rendezvous with death when spring brings back blue days and fair. It may be he will take my hand and lead me into his dark land, quench my breath, close my eyes and quench my breath. It may be I shall pass him still, but I have a rendezvous with death on some scarred slope of battered hill, when spring comes round again this year and the first meadow flowers appear. God knows 'twere better to be deep, pillowed in silk and scented down, where love throbs out in blissful sleep, pulse nigh to nigh and breath to breath. But I've a rendezvous with death at midnight in some flaming town, and I, to my pledged word am true, I shall not fail that rendezvous." But a generation that fought that great war, that awakened in their souls to the story of the loss and suffering in All Quiet on the Western Front, that generation left its memories and its policy in those who at all levels of government came to feel that no war was worth the cost. But one of those German infantrymen, very much like Paul Baumer, Adolf Hitler, thought the war was not some great mistake, but the greatest moment of his life. And he lived to see the world in another such war that would restore the honor of Germany. And because the French and the English politicians were too weak, because the public had been so saturated with this belief that the war was one terrible mistake, the world would find itself, 30 years later, in a far more desperate, far more ghastly, far more destructive war that would cost the life of 50 million individuals.